It's a question about the United Kingdom, so I have to defer to Foz.
Yes.
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 325 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I am Stephen Seagraves, joined by the full host crew today, Seth Miller, Foz Mamoon. Gentlemen, how's the weather?
Cold.
Very, very cold.
I think it's going to get colder as the weeks go on, because we have a big system pushing through this week and headed y'all's way.
Hey, allegedly, there's some snow coming.
Oh, you're gonna get out and shovel?
Well, yeah. I don't have to. I just go clean my parents' driveway, but they have a snowblower, so I got that going for me.
Yeah, I shovel myself out if I have to, but you know, I try not to.
Well, and you mentioned, Seth, that, no, by the way, we're recording this on Sunday, and Seth just woke up from a nap, so if he seems a little slow, siesta was good, you were saying you got a new bandsaw.
I got a new blade. I got the bandsaw a couple weeks ago now, and have been experimenting with different blades and different woods and cutting performance and things like that. I've actually, one of the things I started making, you know, just trying to come up, you know, it was one of those, it was sort of a buy something and then figure out what to use it for.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple patterns and designs that I knew I needed to cut some, be able to cut curves for, and so the bandsaw was helpful for that. But I started making essentially like wine bottle coasters, sort of a giant wine bottle, giant round, like 4 to 5 inch round coaster with a lip on it, so you can put a wine bottle in and, you know, I guess not get the tablecloth dirty. Still use tablecloth. I vaguely remember seeing them growing up in it, like at fancy restaurants, usually metal or minor, made out of wood, and I've been really enjoying making them. So
it's good practice, right?
It is good practice. So, but I was destroying the blade I was using, was having trouble and was binding and things. So I did some research and I decided I needed a different tooth pattern. And so ordered it, and it was due to arrive on Tuesday, but thanks to the miracle of FedEx Home and logistics, it arrived today.
Hmm. And for people who don't know, they're now listening to This Old Woodworker.
So, I'm by no means an expert, but I'm happy to talk about all the fun that happened. The amount of sawdust I can produce in a single day is astounding.
I hope you're using it to help start fires.
I have made some little like fire starter candles using wax out of it. Surprisingly, or probably not surprisingly, you can only make so many of those before you're mind-numbingly bored. And the volume of wax to the volume of sawdust is really challenging. Yeah. I have a 20-gallon garbage can in my basement and like one of those 5-gallon Home Depot buckets or Lowe's buckets, you know what I'm talking about. And so I have a shop vac hooked up to the bucket, and that fills up, depending on what I'm doing and how much, you know, wood I'm routing out, it can be a couple times a day. And that dumps into the 20-gallon. And then when I get the 20-gallon full, I actually like sort of compress it down and really put probably 5 or 6 of the fives in. So, you know, airspace and whatnot. And then I use it as wood. I put that wood onto some of my mulch beds.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Which apparently there's some question about whether that's safe for the wood or not, and whether the acids, like I've checked for the vegetables and the fruit trees and things like that. But I've read that it's okay on blueberry bushes, and we happen to have a lot of blueberry bushes, so that's what I'm going for right now.
Nice, nice.
Yeah. And bright colors on now because of the different woods. It's really
fun. Let's jump into some travel news after. Yeah, I think so. I think so. I don't know.
If anyone's still listening.
I picked the wrong podcast. COVID testing rules now, including U.S. inbounds, but not international connections.
So it's been a little while since we recorded, and this actually – I threw this on the list back when Trump was still president, so that gives you some context. But the rules are changing rapidly for borders, and part of that was Trump announced that they were going to – that the U.S. government was going to require pre-flight testing of everybody, but also drop the ban on inbound flights from Europe and I think Brazil – but not from China, which were the three sort of geographic areas that had explicit bans from last March. And like an hour after one of the news wires leaked that this might be happening, the incoming Biden administration put out a statement saying he's free to do that, but it won't take effect until a week after he's gone. And if he does, we will have immediately reimposed it on day one of our administration. So don't get your hopes up. So is it like, and that was like within 3 hours, sort of a whiplash flip flop situation going on there. The one weird quirk about the policy is and was that if you're traveling via the United States to onward to a different third country, you're not required to have a test, apparently, which sort of like to, you know how like Hawaii, everybody's like, oh, well, everybody going on the flight to Hawaii has to be tested, so it's much safer. Mm-hmm. You only have to be tested going to Hawaii if you want to avoid quarantine there. So technically, you don't have to have a test. You can just go and show up at the airport and they'd be like, okay, and where's your testing paperwork? And be like, no, I don't have a test. I'm just going to quarantine when I get there. And they would let you. And so you could be the untested passenger on board with all these other people that think they're super safe. And you could be, you know, diseased, as it were. So that's like the same thing could now be happening on all these flights. It's super weird to me.
Well, because we don't have true transit either. It's not like people stay in a transit area, right? Like it's
right. You're still clear.
Yeah. So you're still entering the United States, just now sans test if you're connecting. And we all know how easy it is to cancel a flight if you don't want to continue
just walk away. But yeah. Like, would you buy an international internet, like buy an onward connection somewhere at that expense just to skip the test? I don't know.
What is a connection defined as?
I would assume single PNR, like under 24 hour kind of thing. Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, the industry describes it as less than 24 hours, so.
Doesn't necessarily mean the government will enforce that.
Yeah, but how
the government's depending on the air. The government depends on the airline for enforcement. That's the other thing.
Yeah, the government's not doing anything, right? They're not actually checking this stuff.
One would presume when they have to go through immigration, they would.
No, that's why the U.S. government has completely pushed all the validation to the airlines.
Well, we'll see how well that works out.
Foss seems unconvinced that it's going to work. Well,
and then on top of that, there's now been a lot of discussion about possible real quarantine, like managed hotel, you're isolated, not please stay home, we promise, and promise us that you'll be good. So it's getting even more complex in some ways. There's also the UK is talking about similarly adding a real managed quarantine option. Israel just closed its borders over the weekend. The Netherlands had proposed real quarantines and were going to include flight crews, which sort of makes sense since, you know, the crew was out there and if they had an overnight layover or whatever, potentially without, socializing and getting into trouble, getting exposed, whatever. And announced that in response to that shutdown or shut into that rule that they were just going to stop flying long haul, which is insane. It was like 270 daily flights or something. But they're like, yeah, we can't quarantine our crew every time they come home.
And so have they stopped now flying?
No, they announced it because that rule like hadn't taken effect yet. It was supposed to take effect this week at some point. And so they negotiated it back to they could use antigen tests, which are the sort of 5-minute quick test, not the PCR swab. And that the antigen pre-trip and post-trip would be acceptable to the Dutch government for the flight crews. So they actually managed to negotiate it down to something that was more reasonable for the crew. I don't know. I understand why like flight crew doesn't want to ever have to go through all these testing regimens, but as I was just saying before, like they are high risk just based on exposure and travel and stuff. Like except in certain countries where they don't stay on the ground anymore, especially like China, most airlines are stopping their crew being overnighting in China because of the quarantine requirements being too strict. There's a lot of places where it's just like, yeah, welcome, thanks for being here, and no rules about their behavior.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that's one question I have is with some of this stuff, like I've seen some people advocating for, you know, having a 10-day quarantine in the United States is a poor decision because, you know, a lot of people can go to somewhere like Turks and Caicos and there's been like 3 deaths and very few cases and people are going to be relatively safe there. And you're just encouraging people now to just go between, you know, Florida or somewhere else and rather than go international. I'm not sure I buy that argument. It seems a little poorly thought out, but that's some of the stuff I've seen.
For me, getting to Hawaii, I mean, I guess I get a nonstop to either of those locations, right, out of Boston. Yep. Right? Hawaiian did restart its service to Honolulu, and I believe JetBlue still has its Turks and Caicos flights. One is a 4-hour flight, and one's a 10-hour flight. So is it more dangerous for me to be on a 10-hour plane, you know, on the plane for 10 hours or for 4 hours? I'm not sure that that's really significant. And then, yes, there's places you could go that are lower risk. Hawaii and Turks and Caicos have had comparable number of deaths, basically. Maybe, Turks and Caicos is a little lower based on what you just described. Mm-hmm. But I sort of understand it. I think the bigger challenge is what can they actually legislate and manage and require, right? It's easy to close international borders. It's much harder to manage state to state and other things. So, although Hawaii did pull it off, right? Hawaii shut down. They kept everybody out and established real quarantine. So it can be done, but it's not easy and it required the state to do it, not the feds. But in the meantime, we now have a mask requirement on planes and trains and buses for interstate travel. So,
and I mean, hopefully that helps with some of this. I'm hopeful. I think that we are reaching a point now where travel is becoming harder and harder. I mean, that's a good thing. But I don't know that we've reached a point in the virus that it matters anymore. And that's just kind of my personal.
Yeah. Like, I mean, also over the weekend here, Israel completely announced it's completely closing its air border, right? They're closing the airport. Ben-Gurion is like, no, just you're done. Sorry. Yeah. And it's interesting to me how many countries in the face of the new variants that are more transmissible are getting way stricter in terms of lockdown. I mean, Israel is like 30% vaccinated already as a country, but is still, in the meantime, going hard locking down.
To prevent people so that they can ensure they get more people vaccinated without getting one of these variants introduced.
Yeah, well, I think that's really it, is that these new variants, there's a big concern that if they take hold, they could continue to mutate more or otherwise create challenges longer term. And so the countries really want to get to sort of a herd immunity level where there are fewer hosts available very quickly, faster than these new variants can spread. So yeah. It's interesting.
It is. It is. I was going to say there's also some Canada cuts, right? Like Canada's not closing the borders necessarily. I mean, they're already kind of closed, but they're having cuts to their flights is taking place.
Yeah, that was again, with sort of inbound quarantines and some of the provinces having lockdowns, the airlines there were like, yeah, we're done. So Porter Air has still shut down last March and still is now proposing their newest restart date is the end of March. If they actually resume service, it will be more than a year of downtime, right? So that's insane. But on top of that, both WestJet and Air Canada, both of whom have, returned the 737 MAX to service, have also announced significant cuts to their schedule and to staffing. Like, I want to say Air Canada had another 1,000 layoffs as a result.
Wow.
And it's saying basically, like, you're not letting people travel. You're not letting people fly. There's too many rules. There's too many the quarantine rules basically are making it so there's no demand, and so we can't afford to fly.
Yeah. Makes sense. I mean, and then on those same lines, Norwegian has completely killed long-haul flight.
Yeah, I can't say I'm surprised.
I mean, they were already kind of struggling, right? Like, they've been struggling with international stuff for a while.
The long-haul, low-cost sort of 787 services, depending on who you believe, was always a complete disaster or just partially a mess and was, with a little bit of tweaking to routes and operations, probably could have survived. They had announced in late 2019 that the flights to Copenhagen, Oslo, and Stockholm to the U.S. and to Asia were already done for the summer 2020, even before COVID. So, right, those were already on the way out, and that was part of the writing of the route map to try to get things back into service. It didn't – obviously never got a chance to try that. But even on top of that, there's also, questions about they were the largest carrier by seat count from New York City's three international airports, the Port Authority airports. I think they might have included Stewart as well, to Europe. They're bigger than BA,
which is incredible.
Bonus seats, yeah, and had been since like early 2019, I think.
How is that possible?
Because they had so many 787s flying 300-something. All of their 787s had more seats on them than any of the planes BA was flying.
Okay.
And they had – it was more than just London. They had Rome. They had Paris. They had et cetera. I forget which other – Barcelona, I want to say. A few others. Madrid, maybe. So and they had enough daily flights sort of scattered to each of the airports that they offered more seats. Right, their 787 was like 300-something, and BA's was 180, 220, something like that. So, right, if they each had two flights a day, Norwegian was 50% more seats every time, and it added up.
That's crazy. Yeah. I didn't know that.
So, fun times.
I mean, what do you think this does long-term? I mean, right now, it's hard to predict pricing, right, at this point, with transatlantics being cut so severely. But with Norwegian gone, when COVID is finally over in, 2 years or whatever, time frame it is, do you think prices will see a direct impact from this? Or because I always felt like Norwegian, everyone said, Norwegian has cut prices so much across the Atlantic, and I never really saw a huge price decrease unless you lived somewhere on the East Coast.
I would say anywhere Norwegian flew, there was a substantial difference. I remember LA to Stockholm being like $300 one way.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the pricing absolutely shifted dramatically. I was actually having a conversation with a friend of the show, Jason Rabinowitz, airline flyer, this weekend, earlier today, about who still has one-way transatlantic flight pricing now. WOW is gone, and Norwegian is gone. And those two sort of forced the other carrier's hand at doing it, and now it doesn't exist anymore. And it's... who does? And I think TAP does, at least on some routes.
And Icelandair, maybe.
Icelandair used to, but I think that was tied to WOW when I searched. I mean, I admittedly, I only spot checked, but I couldn't find one-way route pricing at half price.
Oh, interesting.
I did find, bizarrely, Boston to London. Alitalia has a one-way fare filed, but that may be a vestige from trying to compete with Norwegian, because the price was about the same as what Norwegian used to charge. While, you know, connecting to Boston to Rome on that same nonstop to Rome and without the back, you know, the connection back up across Europe, was triple the price. So, you know, if you're looking for a nice hidden city fare and don't have checked luggage, or you can schedule a long enough connection that they'll let you short check it, that's a good way to save a few hundred dollars. And it was hundreds of dollars cheaper for the one way. It was like 800 something versus, or 600 something versus 300.
Yeah.
So
nuts.
Yeah.
In I guess status news, Alaska is rumored to be starting a 100K flyer status.
I think it's, we can go beyond rumored. They sent the email, right?
They sent the email, just no details.
Yeah, they're still trying to figure out what they can give you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the key here, is it's unclear what exactly it's going to be, because they've already said the MVP gold 75Ks will be whatever the highest, Emerald. Whatever, in one world. You're going to be a Emerald as a 100K flyer. But what else can they give you? Is it, you know, more upgrade certs, more miles? I don't know. Like, I don't know what it's going to be. But
system-wide?
I was going to say, the system-wide thing is interesting as a potential, because they alluded to that with the AA partnership, but I think they implied that the 75K tier would get those, right?
Yeah, they did. Yes. And that's what they've given us as documentation, is that 75Ks will get those.
So it could just be more of those. They also, in the email, said something about lounge access, but weren't clear on exactly what that was. You know, if it's just the One World Emerald level lounge access, that's not nearly as much fun.
Yeah, I mean, if they gave Alaska flyers that flew 100K Alaska lounge access, that would actually be
massive.
Nice. Yeah, that'd be nice. I mean, as long as, you know, it came as an actual membership, because then you could use it at the AA clubs domestically, which would be welcome.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's still an open question on whether Alaska 75K, you know, One World Emerald would work at an AA lounge on a domestic trip. Technically, unless they explicitly exclude it, it should, right? This is United Gold at, you know, the Turkish lounge or the Lufthansa lounge or whatever. It's that partner.
Very true. Yeah.
But also historically, they were smart enough to exclude that when it was US Airways and American had the partnership.
Yeah. I think that's a big thing too, because, like, I'm thinking of airports that I've flown out of, Newark being the main one, is, you know, AA and Alaska share the terminal. AA has the club, which is probably the only halfway decent seating in that terminal. But I could never access it as a domestic flyer. So,
womp, womp, womp.
Womp, womp, womp. So I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I really wonder how many 100K flyers they have. That would be my...
Well, I wonder if they're going to, with the AA partnership, if they're going to change the way they do Alaska-only earning.
Mm.
That might be what triggers it.
Gotcha. Like,
right, maybe,
because they've talked about bonuses on first class fares are changing, right? Like, what bonus miles you
get. Published some of them, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're clearly figuring some stuff out.
Do you think then it would be kind of some bonuses for flying Alaska Metal? Is that kind of the key, or
could be, right? I mean, it's, who knows, right? And what if they did 75Ks only for Alaska Metal and 100,000 for, and if you do other partners?
Mm, gotcha. Yeah.
But did they just make a big deal out of changing all the qualifications in partner flying the other way?
I haven't paid enough attention, but I do believe so, yeah.
I just wonder, because, like, for me, I've flown 100,000 miles with them once, 1 year. Every other year, it's been like I just do just enough to get 75K. And
it's a lot to fly 100,000 on Alaska.
You're telling me.
And you live in the hub.
I say, you basically got to commute Transcon long haul every week, or every other week.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was doing. I flew them for pretty much every week, when I did that. So, and that was Transcon.
Yeah, right. If you think of it as 2,000 miles a week,
that's really hard to do, even just like within the West Coast, or even some of their mid-cons. I mean, I guess the mid-cons it would work, but...
And what opens it up for me is, like, if they have the American partnership that's actually priced fairly instead of this crazy shit they were doing where, you know, they put up the, you know, the American connections by $500-$600. Like, I could actually go to Canada, you know, to Montreal, where I mostly work, on a mix of the two, and that would be a good commute. So
I will say, I mean, this is sort of this is the JetBlue version of it, but with the JetBlue partnership approved, which Spirit and Southwest are pissed about, even though they got some slots divestitures out of the deal, which I don't, we haven't talked about that, have we?
No.
All right, well, maybe we'll fit it all in this time, but they don't have price collusion as one of the approved things for their agreement. They can coordinate scheduling but not pricing.
Interesting. Which means you're going to end up in more situations where you get weird pricing.
So you remember US Airways always had the, like, was it the upfares or whatever? There's like a weird connecting premium cabin fare almost always on United Metal.
Yes.
And they were like stupidly cheap.
Yep.
Theoretically, I mean, who knows if either JetBlue or American will try to do that, but that sort of imbalance could show up. I have to think that no one really wants to try to undersell their partner that way these days. But
yeah.
I always felt like US Airways was doing that specifically to try to get American to break up with them, not because it was... Let's see how far we can push this sort of thing.
I mean, and speaking of some other stuff, we're gonna talk a little bit about new routes and the JFK United return being delayed in the after show, in the bonus episode for our Patreon subscribers. And we'll probably talk a little bit more about status a little bit on that show, too. We'll see. Weird news. There was a guy living in Chicago for 3 months.
Chicago is cool, but he actually lived at O'Hare.
At O'Hare, yeah, sorry. I'm kind of like out of it. He was living in O'Hare Airport for 3 months. This is like up in the air. What was that movie
The Terminal?
Yeah, The Terminal. Yeah, this is like the real one.
Except he was allowed to leave. He just didn't want to.
Yeah. And what's the story? I mean, he was terrified of COVID, didn't want to fly?
That's the line that was given in the news report. I don't know. That seems a strange explanation to me.
Yeah. So he lived there and they arrested him, right? Like, that's like the story, which I find also
and returned him back to California.
Yeah. But I find it odd. Like, how did they find him? Like, how'd they figure it out?
And why did it take them 3 months to figure it out?
Yeah.
So the part that I read was two United employees walked up to him because they had seen him for a few days or for some time and challenged him on it. He produced a badge, but it wasn't for him. And it was a badge that was reported stolen sometime in October, November, somewhere around there. And that's how they figured out who it was or what he was up to and called the cops and yada, yada, yada.
So it wasn't actually... So the story here is that it wasn't security that figured it out. It was employees.
Yes.
Another banner day for the Chicago Transit Authority Enforcement Division. So
avoid employees.
At least they didn't drag him out of the airport.
Too soon.
Is it, though? I mean, it's been years, guys.
Not really.
My dad already published a book because his, you know, whatever, his no-comment period ended. Anyways.
I mean, it is, he says he found the credentials in Terminal 3. And he was afraid to fly home due to COVID and because other passengers gave him food. Okay, all right. I mean, it's a very bizarre story. I would just be like, 3 months, did he shower? Did he spit bathe? Like, we need more details. Like, I'm wondering.
We really don't need more details. You want more details.
Seth, you posted this on Twitter and I think in our little private chat, and you said AA has published their succession plan.
Yeah, so this was a weird sort of thing, and especially fun was the fact that the senior vice president or whoever that was sort of involved in it got back onto Twitter to explain it. So Brett Snyder, actually, Cranky Flyer, posted this was the first I saw, and it was a couple days after it went. It was originally got published. The company is hiring a new chief human resources officer and hired a headhunter to do this work to help them, you know, find that person. And in the job description, explain that this role is very senior. It will report to this person and that person, but also interact directly with the CEO. And among other things, the company's planning for a new CEO, and that person will also take part in the interview process. So, like, all of that's just sort of weird phrasing. Like, why would you publish that? Like, why would you stick that in the job description? Like, okay, I assume that you can tell me that I'll be reporting, you know, including to the CEO and at that level. And, like, if they show up for the interview, that's cool. If someone else does, that's also cool. I don't know. It was a little weird to include that directly and explicitly in the job description. But then, you know, people are like, well, I mean, they sort of described some of the things that the president, the new CEO would have. And it basically came down to the fact that Isom, who's, I guess, president now or something like that, would be the only person that would qualify. And eventually a lot of times when a transition plan like that is announced, you get an SEC disclosure of, we are, you know, grooming this person to be the next CEO. We expect the transition to happen in X years, blah, blah, blah. They did that when Kirby came to United. There was zero subtlety about the fact that he was going to become CEO when Oscar moved on.
Yeah.
So after a couple hours, I think it just happened like on a Friday evening it came up or something like that. So a couple hours later, the woman Elizabeth something is who this job would actually report to, sort of a level below the CEO, finally caught up to the fact that this was all happening and responded to Brett and was like, maybe I was a little too explicit, whatever, in, you know, describing the role, but of course it's going to be Bob as would be the successor. If you guys, like, we haven't been shy about that. Of course we think it's going to be this. But also, there's zero timetable for it. Doug's not leaving. Hasn't announced anything. Blah, it just got weird. Like, on the list of, like, whiplash sort of changes back and forth within the span of an hour or a couple hours that we've seen in the last couple weeks, this was yet another. So.
Wow.
Sorry, right. Foz. Dougie's not leaving yet.
It's okay. It'll happen in due time. I'll get my popcorn ready.
I was like, but I feel like it couldn't ever be soon enough for you. Like, you've been wanting him gone for since the America West days? I don't know.
You would be, yes, basically. Actually, it wasn't America West. I actually liked America West. It was post-America West.
Yeah, when you stripped U.S. Airways down to bare bones nothingness, that was...
It all comes down to one of the Spokane fairs.
Yeah. Speaking of the random connecting, you know, discounted first class fares that no one else wanted to do.
Hey, those were great while they lasted. BA swaps Tesco, and I'm hoping I'm saying this right, for Sainsbury in the Avios partnership. Like, this is the most random, to me, this is the most random, like, frequent flyer program news ever. But I guess it's a big deal.
It's a huge deal in the UK.
Yeah.
And so it used to be you'd get your Tesco Club points, and I think it was 250 became 500 Avios or something like that. I wrote it down. The earnings rates were pretty good, but are good enough. If it was like however much money you'd get a point for every pound you spent at the grocery store, and then you could convert them over to Avios. And people used those points to help, you know, augment their Avios accounts. It was a good way to help build up your program. It's a good partnership, especially in a market where the credit card earnings are far less robust, shall we say. You know, anything outside the United States is sort of that situation. That was an interesting situation. But they announced back in October, I think, of last year that partnership was going to end, and it ended as of the 21st, the 22nd, and was immediately announced that Sainsbury's would be the replacement. And Sainsbury's has Nectar is the program, and it's similar to Tesco, but it's a coalition program. So it's rewards not just from the grocery store, but from a bunch of different other angles and, you know, partners as well. But again, those can all be converted into the Avios program. And at first blush, the earning rate isn't as good. I really had started writing something about this, and now I've lost that story, so I'm a little disappointed. Do I still have this open? I really had done a bunch of research on this for a blog post, and I lost it all. Damn it. Tesco partnership.
It's all that sawdust.
The Tesco partnership used to be 250 points that would convert, 250, you know, pounds of spending would convert to 600 Avios, and now it's 450-1.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as good, but Head for Points over in the UK, Rob had written about the fact that all the bonuses for Sainsbury earning are generally better and easier. So as long as you're sort of an active Nectar app user as you're doing your shopping, it probably won't be as bad as it sounds initially. This does presume that you're willing to switch your grocery store from Tesco to Sainsbury's.
Yeah.
And it'll be real interesting to see. I mean, if they told you you had to switch, you know, grocery stores in the U.S. are regionalized, so it's hard to say. But, like, if they tell me I had to switch from the good grocery store that I like to a different one just to earn some travel points, I'm not sure I would be keen on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you know, it's interesting. If we had grocery store earning, I would actually be really happy right now during COVID, because that's where I spend most of my money now.
But do you use a credit card that earns double or triple points on groceries?
I do. Yeah. So I guess I would have to give that up. It's one or the other, right? Like,
what are you going to do with all these miles?
No fucking clue. Book some tickets and cancel.
Yeah, but that's not COVID specific, Stephen. That's just your normal MO.
We got our one F-bomb in, too. I was the one who did it. So
it's how
thank
he feels.
You for reminding me. I kind of missed that. I would have tried one later.
It's how he gets back to normal.
Yeah, it's how I feel normal. Yes.
I get you. But, like, it's a really interesting take, right? I also use a credit card that gets me bonus earn for groceries, which, you know, makes a lot of sense to me. But it's independent because it's the grocery chain that negotiates, or the credit card company that negotiates that, not the groceries. And so, you know, I'm not sure if I'd want to change that behavior for points so much. I like the grocery store we go to.
So, I mean, I guess that's a question for Foz. Foz, would you switch it up? Would you change your grocery stores if this is the way we earned here in the U.S.?
No, because I don't need more miles. My miles are worthless as it is.
Well, Bastion, Delta CEO in earnings last week, said he really expects there to be a run on redemptions once things open up.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you got to keep doing. You got to make your redemptions sooner rather than later, right? Be looking for open space.
I'm not too worried.
No, you're not?
No.
Why not?
Because there'll be something else. There's always, I mean, I've never felt like the points were truly worthless or that I wasn't going to ever be able to use them for redemptions.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, right now, like, if you want to look at it that way, many trips are very cheap for a cash ticket. Why would I?
Very
cheap. If you're taking the long game view of this, why burn them now versus later? The counterpoint to that is, why, you know, should you hold them and expect that they'll go up in value later? And
should we rename the show back to what it was originally?
Points orders?
Yeah.
I think, you know, just to finish that thought up, I don't think the answer is always hoard points or always just redeem as soon as you can. But, you know, don't expect that the value is going to necessarily go up, but also, like, don't be stupid about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Some more BA stuff. They're having some trouble in Ghana right now. What's the story here?
Trouble is relative. So BA has tried to sort of adjust some of its flight schedules to keep some flights happening at Gatwick.
Mm-hmm.
Is the short version, right? There's total number of flights is going to be down for the summer. They're still working through the details on what the slot waivers are going to be and all that. But total number of flights are going down, and they're sort of trying to spread things around so they can keep their crew, you know, engaged and whatnot. And so the Gatwick-based crew needs some long-haul routes. They're like, we got this Ghana service. It's mostly point-to-point, I would assume. So they don't have a lot of onward connections. So why don't we just move that over to Gatwick instead? And, you know, from that perspective, it makes a little bit of sense. It's been at Heathrow, and which, you know, fine, but they want to move it over. The government of Ghana is not amused by this change. They have announced, like, that they're seeking to revoke the Ghanaian end slots unless BA moves it back to Heathrow.
Oh, my God.
Why? So,
because Heathrow's the sexy airport in London and everything else sucks.
God.
Have they ever been to Heathrow? I mean,
clearly not.
Wow, that is bizarre. Do you think BA will cave to it?
I'm not sure BA has much of a choice.
Yeah.
I mean, they certainly have to have the discussion more, but yeah.
Wild.
Yeah.
Just wild. And then TAG, which is the national airline of Angola, has announced a code share with the United States with no specific carrier.
with the United States.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's really the story here. You told us about it, Seth. You said, you know, they've announced a code share, but they never said who.
So they've applied to the DOT to be able to serve the U.S. with their code. And there are, you know, that is a thing. You have to, depending on the bilateral treaties between the countries, you have to get permission to do that sort of thing. So fine. But yeah, they have basically said, we don't know who, but we're going to try to have the TAG code flying now to the United States. And it could be a TAG metal from Angola, from Luanda to some intermediate point, and then onward on third-party metal, or it could be third-party metal the whole way. If there's someone who already flies to Luanda that they could see, can negotiate reasonable commercial terms with. But it's vaguely – I got real excited when I thought TAG was actually going to fly to the U.S. That had me all sorts of happy.
But they're still banned, right? Aren't they still banned on the banned list of carriers?
For safety reasons?
Yes.
I didn't, from entering the United States, I didn't realize they were.
I thought they were one of the banned carriers. Let me see. I know they've been banned from other places.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they would be blocked from, they may have been, let's see here. They were knocked down to, they were knocked off to FAA Category 1, which is like the airlines allowed to fly safely.
And they were banned from the EU starting in 2007.
But there was also like that. There was a little bit of blowback on that, where they threatened to ban all EU carriers from Angola, if I understand it correctly. So there was also that deal where they were supposed to, where Emirates came in to help manage the operation early last decade, and then had about $340 million stuck in Angola that it couldn't get out, and they're like, they walked away because the Angolan people were keeping all the cash no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they already have a code share with Air France, Kenya Airways, KLM, Lufthansa, South African, British Airways, Brussels Airlines. I mean, just based on that list, I mean, I wouldn't actually be surprised if they tried to strike up a deal with Delta, honestly.
Yeah. Oh, look. Yeah, the ban was finally relaxed in April 2019 when they repaired enough of their airplanes. The ban was actually explicit to specific, had specific airplanes listed even.
Wow. Wow. Let's see here. I want to see something about Luanda, because I think, didn't a U.S. carrier fly there for a while?
No. Really?
I'm trying to remember.
I would have had to assume it would have been like the Oil Express or something.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if it was just that or someone else. It's so hard to find the history of an airport. Interesting. Okay. I don't know. I'm not going to hold up the show. The other thing I want to talk about, Seth, just kind of, we didn't have this in the notes, but was the new airport in Chengdu. You said underwent some test flights.
Yes.
And it's kind of a big deal. I didn't realize this airport was even being built.
You know, it's just going to handle tens of millions of passengers a year. It's no big deal.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of goes back to that discussion of, you know, there are tertiary cities in China that are bigger than primary cities in the United States, which is just wild.
Like many of them. Most of them. Yeah, it's interesting. So like five or six airlines all showed up and did test flights. And they had like, I want to say China Southern brought a 380, Air China brought a 777, like a bunch of airlines brought their wide bodies, and then smaller airlines brought single aisle planes. They actually made it, the government made, I would say, the appropriate level of big deal out of it to sort of bring all the airlines in, everybody to do something. A lot of the airlines did sort of special flights to, you know, demonstrate their performance, whether it was like a sort of like a tour kind of thing, because it's a flight to nowhere, essentially, to sort of proving that the runways all worked and taxiways and whatnot and testing all that stuff. So that happened last week. Pretty cool. I was looking at it, though. The airport itself, the old Chengdu airport, isn't tiny. It had a couple terminals. It was on the transit network, if I remember correctly. But it was pretty close to town. This new one is way out of town.
Where is it in relation to the city?
It is to the east-southeast, I'll say.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So yeah, it's pretty far away, and the explanation there is yes, but it's right. It's going to still have transit, you know, metro to downtown, and it's going to be a station on the high speed lines. Mm. And as you know, China's investment in high speed train is massive, and so having that connectivity directly in the terminal is significant. I'm trying to pull it up and see about how far it will be. Yeah, it was test flights. TFU is the airport code, it looks like. Aw, Chengdu brought their ARJ-21.
Oh, how sweet.
Yeah, it's a massive building. They've got an airport between the two terminals. Oh, sorry, not an airport. A hotel between the two airport terminals that operates with a transit area, which is nice.
Holy shit, I just found it on the map. It is way out there.
Yeah. I mean, six different airlines, yeah.
It's way out there. Damn.
So I'll include, I got a thread from a local Chinese reporter who's really good at this stuff.
And the old Chengdu airport is going to stay open. There's actually going to be a link between the two airports.
So that's the interesting thing I'm not unclear on is what's the link going to be? Like, are they going to put a separate rail line in or something?
No, they're going to fly a flight.
Say it's far enough, they could. Is it further than Ellington to Intercontinental?
Yeah, I mean, this has got to be like 60 miles. Least. Oh, Google has a thing. Hang on. I can check it.
Yeah. I mean, it's super far out of town.
Do this. Right click. They have a measured distance. There we go. It is straight line. Straight line. It is 34 miles.
Okay. It's an hour and a half drive on the highways.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's similar to Ellington to Intercontinental.
With the difference is you don't go through downtown. This is all on the outside of town.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's super interesting to me that they're and right. We've known for a while China's building all these massive airports. I just didn't quite realize how many.
Yeah. Crazy. Well, guys, I think that's a show. We'll, on our bonus episode after this, we'll be talking about Allegiant's new routes, United's JFK return delay, and the Bangalore Johannesburg cancellations. And so stick around for that if you're a Patreon subscriber. And we just want to say thanks to Matthew Haskip, Arthur Larson, Megan Jameson, Jeff Alamore, Ben Brockert, and Mike Russo. Thanks for being new Patreon subscribers. And to the rest of you, happy travels. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Catch you next time.